Hello and welcome to the Belt and Road Podcast, where we cover the latest news, research, and analysis on China's growing presence in the developing world. I'm your co-host, Juliet Liu. Eric can't join us today, but I'm coming to you from unseasonably warm Berkeley, California. I want to remind all of our listeners that if you want the latest updates, you can follow us on Twitter or Facebook, where we post the latest news, research, and discussions on China's Belt and Road Initiative, and we're at Belt and Road Pod. Much of the discussion around the Belt and Road exists at really high-level politics, for example, large-scale studies of China's global investments or aggregate statistics estimating the current and potential impacts of Chinese integration, or it's zoomed into this level of very specific projects and their relationship to host country politics. But more and more people are arguing that there are subtle but extremely important links between domestic politics in China and the logics around which the Belt and Road Initiative is being rolled out. One of these really important links that's often ignored is this process of decentralization that's been going on in China over the last few decades. There's been a relegation of power and governing capacity from Beijing down to the province levels, and that's fundamentally changed pathways and approaches to development within China across its regions. Here to talk to us today about how province-level politics and patterns of development relate to the Belt and Road Initiative is Dr. Tim Summers. Tim is a senior consulting fellow on the Asia-Pacific program at Chatham House, and he's a lecturer at the Center of China Studies at the Chinese University of Hong Kong. He's an author of three books. The first is on Yunnan, a Chinese bridgehead to Asia that was published in 2013. In 2018, he came out with China's Regions in an Era of Globalization, which specifically talks about different sub-regions within China and how they relate to the Belt and Road. And most recently, and very timely considering current events, he's published this year a book called China's Hong Kong, The Politics of a Global City. And his current research is looking at China in the context of wider shifts in the global political economy, not just including the Belt and Road, but focused partly on that, and looking especially at the Europe-China and UK-China relations, as well as with perspectives from Hong Kong. Tim, welcome to the Belt and Road Podcast. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. Great to talk to you, Juliet.
Yeah. So I wanted to start off and just, you know, you have such a range of topics that you look at. Can you tell us a little bit about your background and how you came to China studies and how you focusing on Yunnan and then more broadly on China's regions?
Yeah, sure. Well, I first came to China over 20 years ago, actually to Hong Kong at that stage and worked here. I'm speaking to you from Hong Kong in the years after the handover. I was a British diplomat back then, and my next posting was to Chongqing in sort of central southwest China from 2004 to 2007. Mm. And really what I was doing in Chongqing was engaging with China from, you know, an international perspective as a foreign diplomat, but doing so very much at a non-national level, at a provincial level. And I used to visit Yunnan quite frequently. It was part of the patch of southwest China that we covered from our office. And sort of starting to talk to people in Yunnan back in those days and sort of finding out that there was quite a lot of, you know, what some people have called paradiplomacy, the idea of provinces engaging in their own sort of international interactions with, in the case of Yunnan, primarily China's neighbors in Southeast Asia. And that was what got me thinking about my topic for my PhD, which I started in January 2008 here in Hong Kong at the Chinese University of Hong Kong. And so I did my PhD research really looking at Yunnan as a province, looking at its political economic relations externally across trade, investment, membership of regional organizations, policy debate and policy development. Also a little bit at some of the sub-provincial dynamics within Yunnan too. And that's what ended up becoming my first book back in 2013, Yunnan, a Chinese bridgehead to Asia. And the title kind of gives away the argument there, that there's a sort of process of Yunnan changing from being a relatively peripheral, closed corner of southwest China into a province which imagined itself being some sort of bridgehead or connector between China and those neighboring countries.
Right. And that's something that I've referred to as well, and that I read when I was starting out in my PhD like 5 years ago. So in that book, it kind of sets up your second book on Chinese regions in an era of globalization by kind of focusing on that periphery. And then you argue later that a lot of the discussion around how China is becoming linked to the global economy is actually focused on coastal China. And I would definitely agree with that. But you write in the 2013 book on Yunnan that
you know, in 2009, for example, five coastal provinces accounted for 3/4 of China's trade, and the top 9 coastal provinces for 91% of the total trade. That's a crazy kind of aspect of the economic geography of China, which is, I think, often glossed over now that we're so focused on China as a global power. So can you flesh out that kind of that contrast between eastern coastal China versus the rest of the country's development and why you see that as key to understanding also the global connections?
Yeah, and I think, you know, the other thing that I think I've always been thinking about during this period is, you know, trying to explain and understand why China's economy developed in the rapid way that it has done from the 1980s. And I think one of the very powerful explanatory factors in this is the idea of China integrating into the global economy, right? Whether you see that through Chinese policy terms like reform and opening up, or if you look sort of from the outside at the incorporation of China into a globalizing capitalist global economy. So China's relationship with the way that globalization changed from the 1980s onwards, I think, is an important way of understanding why China grew in the way that it has. Right. But it struck me that that engagement, that integration into the global economy really started from coastal regions. Mm-hmm. I mean, initially from a few small special economic zones, gradually spreading up the coast in the 1980s. And that really 1980s and 1990s in particular, in spite of some efforts by inland provinces to engage the global economy, actually saw really the coastal parts of China engaging in foreign investment in external trade. And there's obvious logics to that. A lot of China's economic engagement with the global economy then was manufacturing goods for export, for consumption in other markets. And so the logistics connectivity of coastal ports gave them a big advantage over somewhere like Yunnan in southwest China, which was much more distant and much more cut off. And then, as we know, around the end of the century, the central government started thinking about how to close the gap in development between inland China and coastal China, which had grown through the reform period. And so we have this Develop the West policy platform, very broad, big framework that was introduced to try and encourage, to sort of tilt investment and economic activity inland as much as possible. But difficult to do. I mean, starting from a point where around the year 2000, 2001, when China joined the WTO, those coastal provinces were already very much ahead in terms of economic development and of their connectivity to the global economy.
Right, yeah. And you see that, I mean, you said yourself, you had visited Yunnan many times, and there was all this dialogue when I was living in Yunnan from 2009 to 2011 that they were Luohu compared to the eastern coastal areas. And that changed really rapidly. But yeah, you also describe kind of not only an effort to develop, to reduce the inequality between the provinces, but there was also, from what I understand, a process of decentralization, shifts in terms of the province level power vis-a-vis Beijing. Can you explain a little bit of what was happening, what the timeline was there, and what structures kind of reshaped province level development?
Yeah, and I suppose this was another important feature of the reform era, particularly in economic policy, and also relating to the management of international trade and investment. So there's an external element to this as well. So the idea that more power, more say was given to provincial level actors in engaging with the global economy as they sought to develop. And I think that's been a trend throughout the 80s, 90s, that earlier period of reform. Mm-hmm. I mean, more recently, perhaps we should also just think about it in terms of the scale. You know, the scale of the economies of some of these provinces, a province like Guangdong that has an economy that's larger than Indonesia's, the Greater Bay Area that people have been talking about a lot recently, economy similar in size to that of South Korea. I mean, these are big, substantial, quite sophisticated chunks of China's economy, and it makes sense for them to have, you know, a reasonable amount of latitude to drive their strategies forward in their external economic engagement.
Right. Can you remind us what the Greater Bay Area refers to?
Yeah, so the Greater Bay Area is the Guangdong, Hong Kong, Macau Greater Bay Area, the 9 sort of core cities in Guangdong province, which we used to refer to as the Pearl River Delta concept that you know, came to prominence with the way that region was the center of a lot of China's manufacturing industry, for particularly for export in the reform era. So it's those 9 cities plus Hong Kong and Macau, the 2 special administrative regions.
Right.
And so it's a way of, I see the Greater Bay Area really as another iteration, another chapter in the development of this region, because actually economically, the Pearl River Delta and Hong Kong in particular have become increasingly connected and integrated from the 1980s onwards. Without Hong Kong capital and know-how, that region of China wouldn't have become the export manufacturing powerhouse that it did. This, I think, takes it to a new stage, and reflecting the way that the economies within Guangdong have become increasingly sophisticated, places like Shenzhen, which are centers of high-tech manufacturing, in particular with some of those big, you know, well-known Chinese companies like Huawei being based there. So I think this is actually, I see the Greater Bay Area plan as being a desire to build a globally competitive economic region, right, that has the advantages of what's been a dynamic manufacturing sector in Guangdong, plus the international financial sector and legal system and so on of Hong Kong. But whatever the plan is, whatever the government does, and this has been one of the most dynamic parts of China's development for the last 40 years, and I expect it will continue to be, you know, irrespective of what's going on in Hong Kong at the moment.
You made the point a little bit earlier, and this is the meat of what I was hoping to get to, that you can't really understand China's expansion into the global economy without kind of understanding those inequalities across the provinces and also the shift in power that the provinces have undertaken as China is going global. What do you think are the key aspects that really you miss if we're just focused on the East Coast, or if we're just treating China in this kind of monolithic sense? You know, what do we misunderstand, or when we leave out the Western China and the province level analysis?
I think probably the main thing we miss is the diversity of China's economy. And that comes through in those trade statistics you cited earlier. And just looking at the data, the degree to which different parts of China's regional economy are connected to the outside world differs hugely. But there's also diversity in terms of natural resource endowment. There's diversity in terms of population size and scale and density, geography, industry, and so on. So I think looking sort of below the national level, you really see this, you know, this huge diversity of economic development across China. And actually, I think that then, to sort of go back to Yunnan a little bit, I mean, that then also feeds into the discussions about the Belt and Road that you started off with. Because as you say, the Belt and Road is often seen as a national level, centralized strategic plan, and in some ways it is. You know, that analysis is very valuable. But I think the Belt and Road also emerges out of the way that many of China's provinces and subnational regions have been looking to engage with the global economy over a significant period of time. You can go up to Xinjiang in the 1980s, work of someone like Gay Christopherson, who's told the story of how this Silk Road imaginary was a way that provincial, regional elites wanted to develop their economy externally. When Belt and Road came out in 2013, 2014 as an idea, I must admit, I thought, hang on, that sounds very much like what I was studying and researching and reading about in Yunnan beforehand. You know, this idea of connecting yourself through infrastructure development, regional cooperation and coordination, trade and investment to neighboring markets in order fundamentally to develop, to deliver a greater level of economic and social development. Mm. So I think the sort of ideas behind the Belt and Road really come out of this diverse, differentiated picture of the way that China's regions and provinces have engaged globally.
Yeah, and I noted in our communications before chatting today that, you know, there's a lot of people who have connected China's Go West campaign to the Belt and Road. But in the Third World Quarterly article that you have from 2015, you really go beyond that and talk about these specific political logics, even slogans that kind of transfer from province level campaigns or regional kind of campaigns into these global Belt and Road strategy and policies within China that kind of translate clearly into the Belt and Road rhetoric and approach. So I liked how that was, the rhetoric that's happening, but also the specific structure of the policies. You make an emphasis about comparative advantage being something that they want, you know, each singular province to take advantage of. And I just found that a really robust and interesting analysis.
Yeah, right. And I think you can see that in the way that different provinces and cities are sort of assigned roles within the government's own vision and actions document from March 2015 on the Belt and Road initiative. And I think there's a lot of complicated politics and things going on behind the scenes there. Zheng Jinghan, for example, has written about Jiangsu in this context. There's lots of, I think, interesting stories that can be uncovered by research over the coming years. But yeah, basically, you know, the Belt and Road is not a single sort of monolithic Chinese economic entity engaging externally. It's actually China engaging at multiple levels, at multiple scales. And so the engagement with Southeast Asia through Southwest China is different from the engagement with Southeast Asia through Southeast China or with Central Asia through Northwest China and so on. And so it's more than a development of the develop the West, the Go West policy. You know, it's actually a framework that I think brings in a role for multiple regions right across China, not just those Western
provinces. Right, I think it's the same document that you're referring to, the 2015 Vision and Actions document. You talk about these, how it breaks China up into four broad macro regions. And I found that super fascinating because even in my own interviews, people had referred to them like, oh, well, dealing with Myanmar is Yunnan's job, you know, or dealing with, dealing with Vietnam is Guangxi's job, and Yunnan is supposed to deal with Burma and Laos. And the Chinese people I'd interviewed had really specific ideas of how these regions connected. And then you really document that in the official Belt and Road vision statements. Can you talk a little bit about those kind of four broad macro regions and how are they like really different relationships between China and the world that are negotiated through those different provinces?
Yeah, and I think those four macro regions, you know, it's a fairly broad framework that sort of structures that document. And one of the things I found interesting about that, and I wrote about this a bit in my book on China's regions, is the way that those four macro regions are different from the macro regions that structure other government policy statements. So, you know, typically regional policy within China has been demarcated between the coastal regions, the central regions, the western regions, and then sometimes the northeastern regions, depending a bit where you look. But these four macro regions in the Belt and Road are rather different. You have the northwest and the southwest as two different regions there. And then you have coastal regions, and then you have the sort of inland section. So it's a different way of thinking about the economic geography of China that I think comes from thinking about its external connectivity. So rather different from the, you know, that previous structure of coastal inland or coastal central western region is an economic geography which flows from starting at the coast and moving inland, right? That story of trying to move growth inland. And I think that's what prompts that particular framework. So I think when it comes to the Belt and Road, yeah, we have a rather different demarcation, a rather different way of looking at China and its connections to the global economy. But those four macro regions, I think they're quite big frameworks. Within those, I think actually there's plenty of scope for contestation and competition. Mm-hmm. And you know, one of the other features of provincial economic development strategies over the reform era has been competitive liberalization, to use Dali Yang's phrase. But I've sort of adapted that to say competitive internationalization. And here in the Southwest with Yunnan and Guangxi, you have quite a good example, you know, where both of those provinces have tried to position themselves as the natural or the most obvious province for China's connections with Southeast Asia. So there's a competitive dynamic that is at work here too, and a bit of sort of contestation and scope for negotiation over what sort of roles different provinces might play, say in economic ties with Vietnam or with maritime Southeast Asia or other parts of China's neighborhood.
Yeah, I mean, it was occurring to me as you were talking about competition between the provinces, but also, do you think that there's potential contradictions between like province level agendas and Beijing level interests? And do you think we've seen any of that, or we just haven't potentially seen Belt and Road develop far enough to see that? But yeah, when I think of Yunnan and versus Yunnan's interests versus Beijing's interests, for example, around border security, where they border Burma and also Laos, yeah, that's something where I see Yunnan extracting concessions from Beijing in some cases. Do you see contradictions between province and central level within that Belt and Road framework, or not yet?
Yeah, I think that's right. And there's been quite a lot of work done on Yunnan, particularly in this context. And I think that the issue that you mentioned, border security, a difficult border for China with Myanmar in particular, you know, that part of Myanmar not being under particularly tight control from the Burmese government itself. I mean, that's created a number of security challenges, both sort of traditional security challenges in terms of occasionally conflict breaking out in those border regions, but also the non-traditional security threats of flows of of drugs or people trafficking or infectious diseases and so on. So I think it's fair to say that there are some differences of interests, you know, within the Chinese system. And one way of thinking about that definitely is a central local differentiation. But I think we can also think about these as functional differences within the Chinese system. So, you know, maybe within the sort of commercial cone, the Ministry of Commerce and its local equivalents, there's more similar interests between the center and the locality there, perhaps when it comes to the more security-focused parts of the system. Again, there's potential for more similar interests between the center and the locality, but interests that differ from the economic interests. So I suppose what I'm saying is the other way of trying to map out that different interest structure is it's not always central local level. It could also be, you know, economic developmental interests on the one hand versus security, whether traditional or non-traditional security interests on the other. And that can sort of cut through the different layers of government.
Right. You also just have such different levels of openness in terms of those borders. I mean, Xinjiang is completely on lockdown, whereas Hong Kong is in a very different situation, but not, yeah. But yeah, there you have this huge openness of the coastal areas versus, you know, Yunnan, where they have a pretty controlled border, but these insecurity on the Burmese side. But yeah, there's such interesting contrasts between these regions that you compare.
Yeah, and I think the sort of type of activity that takes place as well, the nature of the economy, the sort of balance of economic power and influence between some of these border provinces and their neighbors. I think if you're sitting in, you know, you're sitting in Beijing or Shanghai, Yunnan looks a long way and it looks like a fairly small economy, which it is in the context of China. Now, if you're sitting in Laos or Cambodia or Myanmar, Yunnan's obviously very close,
right, yeah.
And actually pretty big with 45 million population and economy which certainly is more powerful than those latter developed Southeast Asian economy.
Yeah, the population of Kunming, the capital of Yunnan, is larger than Laos, I think, at this point. So that's a hell of a comparison. Always.
That's something to think about, right?
Yeah. Yeah. You also, I mean, I'm really interested also in your future work. So I understand that you're increasingly focused on China's connections to the EU through Eurasia, but also UK-China. I would be super fascinated to hear about the work that you're doing now with Europe and China connections.
Yeah, and this work has got a little bit more of a policy flavor to it, generally looking at some aspects of UK-China relations in particular, and that's partly stimulated by, a couple of things, by what's going on generally in the world with China becoming a more influential power and actually a more contested power in the policy-making processes of many countries, including in Europe. And also what's happening in the UK at the moment with Brexit and, you know, a rather uncertain foreign policy posture going forward. So there's a debate there about what Britain's policy towards China will look like when or if this Brexit story ever comes to an end. That's a sort of ongoing interest. And Hong Kong kind of feeds into that a little bit as well, because it relates, again, I think, to both of those themes, the sort of impact of the rise of China, but also how Western countries in particular are viewing China, perceiving China increasingly as a challenge to them.
Yeah, do you think that the events in Hong Kong right now are making China less and less appealing as a partner to Europe? Or do you think European countries will be able to split their focus from between economic and political?
Yeah, I think, you know, events in Hong Kong certainly are making people in Europe, you know, think. It's another thing that's making people, you know, hesitate, think again about their relations with China. There are plenty of other things that have been going on, though, that I think have contributed to that in more of a structural way. the roots of what's going on in Hong Kong have been there for some time, but you know, this particular sequence of events has come very suddenly to the surface over this summer. But there are other things that perhaps for Europeans, trade and economic relations, you know, a sense that China's become a more difficult market to operate in, concern over the situation in Xinjiang, for example, that I think these are things that have been around for a little bit longer, that probably more influential still at a strategic level on thinking about how to deal with China. But yeah, certainly Hong Kong feeds into that.
Do you think that Italy the only European country that has signed on to the BRI, or there's been a handful of them? It's the only Western European.
No, there's been a few. I think Portugal, Luxembourg, I hope I haven't forgotten someone. There's there's a small number that have signed formal memoranda of understanding.
Right, yeah.
And I think in the Italian case, there was some negotiation over the text there. Of course, domestic politics in many of these European countries can change quite rapidly.
Right, yeah.
And that then can feed back into a changing policy on China. And I think that's one of the other things to think about, that China's become more contested in European politics. And that actually means that when governments change or when things happen, China policy can change more rapidly than in the past.
Right.
But I'd say apart from those countries that have formally signed memoranda of understanding, there are a few European countries, including the UK, that have responded generally pretty positively to the Belt and Road Initiative. At least the previous government under Theresa May, the Chancellor Philip Hammond and others talked about China as a natural partner for the UK through the Belt and Road Initiative. So there's some fairly positive responses, even if signing a formal memorandum of understanding has been a bit too politically difficult,
right.
I think, for some of these governments.
Yeah, and regardless of any of these formal agreements, I mean, China-EU trade relationship is one of the strongest global flows that exists right now. And we had a listener write into our Facebook and send us a message. They were interested in whether the EU negotiating with China as a unified bloc versus member state by member state, whether you thought that would make a big difference, or whether you might see kind of a potential for EU, you know, as a bloc negotiating with China through the Belt and Road in the future, whether it'd keep on being, country by country.
I think when it comes to the Belt and Road, there's been quite a significant country-by-country dynamic, but there's also been some coordination and some policy development at the European level, things like connectivity. And there's always this tension between the European level and national levels, particularly on issues which fall in the foreign policy space, where broadly consensus is needed in order to make policy. So I think we'll probably see this continue to play out at more than one level within the European Union. Actually, sometimes that complexity can actually help in a negotiation because you it gives you some leverage. You've got multiple voices and stakeholders you need to satisfy, so you can go back to the other side and use that sometimes to your advantage. So I don't think we should always see what's often described as a lack of unity in Europe as a problem, right? It depends a bit on the issues and the dynamics of particular things, but it can be a strength. And I think Belt and Road, you know, we tend to think about this as a policy, you know, as a sort of plan, which it is, and there's that level there. But I think the other thing about Belt and Road, and perhaps this is also how the idea emerged as something which attracted, you know, interest and, you know, reasonably positive responses from a number of quarters, is that, you know, Belt and Road, the concept of greater connectivity is not a new concept. It's not a Chinese concept either. It's something that people have been pushing for a long time through multilateral development banks, through the sort of dominant ideas about development. You build infrastructure, you develop trade and investment. It taps into these quite strong, you could say, hegemonic ideas about international development. It also reflects, I think, something that is happening and would be happening anyway, which is China deepening its economic ties with the rest of the developing world, with its neighbors in particular. And these, again, are very deep-rooted things in recent decades. They're going to continue. So Belt and Road sort of sits on top of things that, to a large extent, would be happening anyway. So looking at it from that level, actually what we're talking about is greater economic commercial infrastructure, engagement and connectivity. It's generally been fairly uncontroversial. It's going to continue and it's going to develop more as China's economy and the economies of Southeast Asia and elsewhere continue to grow.
I've been describing it to people as the slogan that the president of, you know, that Xi Jinping has placed on China's general global integration, right? In some ways, it's the slogan is far more, suggests far more unified and specific a project than it really is. I mean, at this point, they're naming educational initiatives or space development and exploration. All of these things have the name Belt and Road tacked to them. So yeah, for me, it seems just basically like the umbrella term for China's global integration.
But I think that's a nice way of putting
it. With the connectivity and infrastructure emphasis, mostly because it's China's comparative advantage, I think. So before we finish our conversation, I really wanted to hear about your book that just came out on Hong Kong, how you decided to shift. Obviously, I mean, it sounds like you've just lived in Hong Kong for so long that you have great perspective. But yeah, do you want to tell us a little bit about how your proceeding work connects to on subnational politics, kind of connects to this Hong Kong book and what we should be excited to get out of it?
Yeah, well, thanks. I mean, the Hong Kong book has emerged more, to be honest, out of, you know, having lived in Hong Kong now for 17 years and watching developments here and seeing really from 2014, from 5 years ago, issues to do with Hong Kong politics moving up the agenda again outside Hong Kong. Of course, people here have always been interested in what's been going on, but you didn't find much written about Hong Kong in the international newspapers until the events of 2014 and the Occupy movement, the umbrella movement in the autumn of that year. And so it was around 2014 that I started again writing about Hong Kong, having written a lot about it in the late 90s in my, you know, previous incarnation. So I started writing and publishing some comment pieces, some short pieces of analysis, building up through one or two journal articles. And I was then, you know, lucky enough to get the opportunity to turn some of these ideas into a book with Agenda Publishing. The idea was to try and take a step back from what I think the dominant perspective on Hong Kong is, that, you know, everything to do with Hong Kong is about its relationship with Beijing. Right. Of course, that is very important. I'm not seeking to downplay that at all. It's a key factor in the way that Hong Kong has been developing. But I think we have, you know, things that are impacting Hong Kong on multiple levels again. It seemed to me, following, say, Brexit and Hong Kong politics, that there's lots of similarities in the sort of tribal nature of politics, the emotional issues of identity. Right? So there's some global political trends, I think, that are at play here. There's obviously the national level politics, but that's also, in Hong Kong's case, reflecting not just political views from Beijing, but also the impact of China's economic development, the scale and the scope and the spillover of that into Hong Kong, which I think has led to some of the dislocations that we've seen. And that also fits with another theme of the book, which is globalization. Right. That globalization has created or has been linked to some of the challenges that we've seen in politics across the developed world over recent years. For Hong Kong, globalization is a lot about the rise of China just because of its proximity. And then there's local politics. You know, people in Hong Kong just don't all see eye to eye on everything. That's natural. That's normal. Sadly, in many ways, the Hong Kong society's become more and more polarized over recent years. That was one of the big legacies of the Occupy movement, I think, and we've seen it worsen and intensify over the last few months. So locally, Hong Kong society has found it difficult to come to consensus on the way forward. So in the book, I try to put all of those things together with some chapters on history, on one country, two systems and its implementation, on economics and society, on some of the recent developments, and on international perspectives on Hong Kong.
I mean, it's interesting that you said that there's been this fracturing in Hong Kong society, because I do think that one of the incredibly successful things that the protesters have done is present a unified front, at least to the outside world, which I think you obviously get completely different points of view from every different kind of media source that you kind of consult. But I do think that's been, they seem to have presented a united front, which I think is different from what you describe in your book a little bit.
Mm. Yeah, and I think, you know, their PR work has been very, you know, very well done and very effective. But I mean, not everybody in Hong Kong takes that perspective. Clearly, you know, the protest movement has a wide base of support, more support for some of the motives and some of the actions than for others. But I think from my experience living here that it is still a divided society, and there are other voices which need to be heard, but are not getting out there just right at the moment.
And I mean, just to end on kind of a Belt and Road related thing, I just realized as we were kind of talking about the different these different regions around China, Hong Kong is so key, and it doesn't get talked about enough how important Hong Kong finance is, but also just how important Hong Kong's like culture of business and its relation to the world has been for the Belt and Road. I mean, I don't know if your research has touched on that, but it occurred to me that, yeah, how can we leave that out?
Yeah, and I mean, interestingly enough, in Hong Kong for the last 5 or 6 years, there's been this kind of ongoing debate about, well, what is the Belt and Road really? How does Hong Kong fit into it? What should Hong Kong do differently to respond to the Belt and Road? I think the short answer to that is probably just carry on being an international business and financial center, sitting nicely on the southern coast of China. And that's probably something that Hong Kong can benefit from, and other parts of China can benefit from as they engage with the global economy. So it probably doesn't require a dramatic change of strategy or change of direction.
Right, yeah, definitely. Well, Tim, it's been fascinating talking to you about this. A really refreshing take, I think, on you know, what should be the focus when we try to understand the Belt and Road Initiative. And just before we get into recommendations, I want to remind our listeners that you've been listening to the Belt and Road Podcast. We cover the latest news, research, and analysis on China's growing presence in the developing world. And we would love for you to follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Our Twitter handle is @BeltandRoadPod. Tim, thanks so much for the amazing conversation. And do you have any recommendations you want to send us off with?
Well, of course, I'd love it if people read my books and learned something from them. And I'd always love to hear from readers to hear what they have to say. You know, there's lots of other good stuff out there to read on China. Lots of good books recently. I think the most recent thing I've read is Yan Xuetong's book on leadership and the rise of great powers, which I thought was very, very interesting and different perspective, but there's tons of stuff. So keep your eyes out for whatever is being published on China.
Definitely. I'm going to recommend the documentary on Netflix. It's American Factory. So it just came out this year. It was directed by Stephen Bognar and Julia Reichart. It focuses on a Chinese company, Fuyao Company, who moved into Moraine, which is a suburb of Dayton, Ohio, which is close to my heart because I went to Oberlin College in Ohio. Dayton is, you know, part of the U.S. Rust Belt, and it's just this incredible documentary on how what happens when this General Motors plant closes down and then gets taken over by this Chinese company. And probably one of my favorite scenes is at the very beginning of the documentary, where there's a Chinese manager explaining America and Americans to the Chinese workers, trying to help them kind of cope with the cultural shock of being in America. And they mentioned that if you're in Europe, if you're traveling in Europe and you see someone who's dressed in really frumpy clothing and sports shoes, it's probably an American tourist and not a European. So that's probably my favorite part of that documentary. Yeah, so those are our recommendations. Tim, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me. And it was really great to get your perspective.
Thanks very much, Juliet. I enjoyed it. It's stimulating to talk, and I look forward to reading your work
too. Yeah, great. Thanks again.